Well, I've been debating, like, literally all the way up until now, whether or not to run into, I think we're going to run into the first bit of 9, just because it picks up a thread that we touched on last week. You know, this, you know, chapter 8 is largely just kind of a mechanical description of the abatement of the flood. Not everything is of interest to everybody, and this is one of the passages that I'm like, let's get on to the other stuff. I guess we can start, and I guess people will trickle in as they may. And let's start with 8, and then just stop when I holler. And we'll just, you know, let's just treat this like there are no chapter designations. And and we'll go from there. So someone want to lead us out with 8.
But God remembered Noah and all the wild animals and the livestock that were with him in the ark. And he sent a wind over the earth, and the waters receded. Now the springs of the deep and the floodgates of the heavens had been closed, and the rain had stopped falling from the sky. The water receded steadily from the earth. At the end of the 150 days, the water had gone down. And on the 17th day of the 7th month, the ark came to rest on the mountains of Ararat. The water continued to recede until the 10th month, and on the first day of the 10th month, the top of the mountains became visible. After 40 days, Noah opened the window he had made in the ark and sent out a raven, and it kept flying back and forth until the waters had dried up from the earth. Then he sent out a dove to see if the water had receded from the surface of the ground, but the dove could find no place to set its feet because there was water over all the surface of the earth, so it returned to Noah in the ark. He reached out his hand and took the dove and brought it back to himself in the ark. He waited 7 more days and again sent out the dove from the ark. When the dove returned to him in the evening, there in its beak was a freshly plucked olive leaf. Then Noah knew that the water had receded from the earth. He waited 7 more days and sent the dove out again, but this time it did not return to him. By the first day of the month of Noah's 601st year, the water had dried up from the earth. Noah then removed the covering from the ark and saw that the surface of the ground was dry. By the 27th day of the 2nd month of the earth was completely dry. Then God said to Noah, "Come out of the ark, you and your wife and your sons and their wives. Bring out every kind of living creature that is with you, the birds, the animals, and all the creatures that move along the ground, so they can multiply on the earth and be fruitful and increase in number upon it." So Noah came out together with his sons and his wife and his sons' wives, all the animals and the creatures that moved along the ground, and all the birds. Everything that moves on the earth came out of the ark, one kind after another. Then Noah built an altar to the Lord, and taking some of all the clean animals and clean birds, he sacrificed burnt offerings on it. The Lord smelled the pleasing aroma and said in his heart, "Never again will I curse the ground because of man, even though every inclination of his heart is evil from childhood. And never again will I destroy all living creatures as I have done. As long as the earth endures, seed time and harvest, cold and heat, summer and winter, day and night will never cease."
Okay. Let's keep going a little bit. And we'll do, some, as I said, some overlap here. We'll come back to this next week, but I definitely want to touch at least the first, let's do the first 7 verses here of 9.
Yes. So God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. And the fear of you and the dread of you shall be on every beast of the earth, on every bird of the air, on all that move on the earth, and on all the fish of the sea. They are given into your hand. Every moving thing that lives shall be food for you. I have given you all things, even as the green herbs. But you shall not eat flesh with its life, that is, its blood. Surely for your lifeblood I will demand a reckoning. From the hand of every beast I will require it, and from the hand of man. From the hand of every man's brother I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply. Bring forth abundantly in the earth, and multiply in it.
We might sneak into a couple more later, but so what stands out for you in this segment here?
I believe that the Lord supernaturally preserved the trees and the plants, because after a year of having water cover even the tallest mountain, all of that stuff should have been dead by modern science. But for him to be able to release a bird just within a few weeks or a month after the water has started to recede and have fresh leaves and stuff, to me that doesn't seem possible without God's supernatural guidance.
Okay.
That's just a theory.
Okay.
Dead as a doornail.
Dead.
We have endless ones of those in this room.
I agree. Wow.
Yeah, it's typical. I actually brought a fresh pack of dry erase markers and left them on the bench like a month ago, and they disappeared. I was hoping they found their way to the basket, but maybe the school took them. That's always been a chronic disease around here, is the death of the dry erase markers, and they're never replaced. Yay!
That's a good one there. Okay, so that's very cool.
It's like when you put the empty milk carton back in the fridge, no one buys milk because there's a carton in there, but yet it's empty. It's the same thing with the markers. They just keep putting the dead ones in the basket.
So, Brother Dave, we're in Genesis 8 and drifting over into 9. So we've got the issue of the plants, perhaps. Did anyone notice anything odd about the timing, the number of days of the water? And this is something that we're going to definitely look at next week. When we take a look at one of the sort of more thorny, oddities of the Bible, but it behooves us to read really carefully, because the way in which the texts are often written is comfortable with non-linear descriptions of time, which I think in our current, maybe in a sense, in our modern way of reading, we have become so perhaps technologically or scientifically oriented that we have lost our ability to be properly literate. In other words, we can only follow something if it tracks absolutely, point for point for point. And when you get things out of order, which makes for, I think, a lot more intelligent storytelling, it can mess with readers. But anything about the amount of time that the flood is prevailing.
Holy feedback, Batman.
That would be a large amount of feedback.
Fascinating.
Glad someone was there.
Pew amplifier just went down.
Yeah. So I have to confess.
Sure.
When we started reading the numbers, I'm just like, I didn't focus.
Yeah.
Focus.
Right. And a lot of times people will do that. And I do think there are certain passages in Scripture that certain people's hardwiring either resonates with or doesn't resonate with. There are passages in Scripture that I just sort of I'm not interested.
You glaze over.
Yeah. I try not to do that, and one of my professors of Old Testament said, a lot of what people consider to be the most boring passages are actually some of the most important. he was referring to the names. You know, when you have lists of names, well, a lot of times people just glaze over that stuff, but those names tell you a lot about the spiritual life of Israel, because in many cases, you know, people will be named after either pagan deities or Yahweh in some respects. So you can actually sort of track what the spiritual pulse was like at the time. This isn't like that, but I want to draw your attention to so how long did the rain, did the flood occur?
Well, it rained for 40 days and 40 nights.
Okay. Right. How did you get that much water? There's, how can you have that much water come down in 40 days and 40 nights?
Yep.
Well, the Bible gives a description that the original system God had, there were waters that would come up from the ground to water the earth in Genesis. Mm-hmm. And then when he describes the flood, it says all the waters broke forth from beneath the earth, the waters in the heavens as well as the waters below. So to me, it sounds like there was an underground aquifer system that contributed, plus the rain, plus quite possibly this excessive moisture canopy around the earth protecting it that also let loose.
Okay.
Has anybody figured out what the waters of the heavens were?
I mean, you have...
It wasn't rain, it was something else.
Yeah, you have all kinds of speculation. That's one of the areas where, you know, you can't be interested or go digging into everything. And that's one of the areas where I confess, like, I don't know. And, I mean, technically, nobody knows.
Right.
And I there are places in Scripture where I think, and I think we've talked about this before, where it's interesting to dig, but if one makes the entire purpose of one's life to dig at that, thinking that I'm going to uncover some secret mystery about God or the universe or something, I mean, like, I suppose, knock yourself silly, but when people invite other people to expend their own time doing this, I think at a certain point, there are kinds of study of Scripture that can be wasteful. For example, you know, trying to figure out when Jesus is coming back. Like, that is a demonstrably wasteful, unredeemed use of one's time, because, you know, obviously the boss told you, I don't even know when it's going to be, so, like, do your job, don't watch the clock. And so when people reject that and then they say, no, it's important for us to figure that kind of stuff out, I don't put that here in that same category, but I would say trying to figure out what the waters were above the, you know, like I don't care. Like, I just, you know, that's me. I don't know. It's in there for a reason, but I don't know what the reason is. And nobody else has been able to establish this. Unless one of you in this room have, you
know, yeah, right,
someone who has.
I am not saying I established it, but what lends to my idea is that when God spoke the words of creation, he said, let the waters be separated, the waters above from the waters below. Mm-hmm. So to me, that kind of adds to the some kind of a, what's the word, supporting point to having a moisture shield around here.
Yeah. And again, what that, you know, I've heard, you know, in the tradition that I grew up, there were lots and lots of people who did spend lots and lots of time, like, worrying, you know, thinking about that kind of stuff.
Wow.
We had went in my high school, which was associated with a Southern Baptist, or Independent Baptist church, right? It was a mega church. And so we had some, like, big wig characters. And one of them had this idea about, yeah, this sort of actual, some kind of a dome-ish thing that was, you know, around the entire world, and, you know, it's very interesting kind of stuff, but, you know,
it's immaterial.
Yeah, it's like, okay, everybody died, everything got really, really wet, but the thing here is it mentions 150 days
at the end of chapter 7.
Yeah, and then later, right, it said, so the water prevailed upon the earth 150 days, right? At the end of 150 days, the water decreased. But
As we're reading this, it says, also the fountains of the deep and the floodgates of the sky were closed, and the rain from the sky was restrained. So it feels like, if you're reading directly, right, the water prevails on the earth 150 days, but God remembered Noah, all the beasts, etc. God caused a wind to pass over the earth. Also the fountains of the deep and the floodgates were closed. So it almost sounds like that's been actually going on, like it was 40 days, but no, it was actually 150 days. And so I think reading this, if you're not careful, it's easy to sort of retcon certain pieces of time back into, you know, some other reading. I think the text is playing loosely with chronological time here, right? So it's already established. You've got a certain period of time that the flood is taking place. The water is sitting camped out on the earth for 150 days. God's remembering this, causing, you know, the wind, etc. Rain is being restrained. It doesn't mean necessarily that at the end of 150 days, then the rain is restrained. But again, it's just one of these little points to be aware of as we read, that when you first maybe feel a tickle of something being off, it's always best to, you know, read again carefully and assume that you're not necessarily...
What about the calendar? So in chapter 7, verse 11, it mentions the day,
yep.
Like the calendar day,
right?
When the whole thing starts. I think in our reading, didn't we have a calendar day when it stopped or when they actually got out of the boat?
Yes.
So, I mean, I'm not real good on the Jewish calendar.
Yep.
Yeah, by the 27th day of the second month, the earth is completely dry,
mm-hmm.
and it's the 17th day of the second month. That looks like a whole year and 10 days,
mm-hmm.
by my reading.
Yes, yes. Yeah. Back in when I was in college, I actually sort of did a timeline. I got really bored.
Did you get extra credit?
No, I didn't tell anybody about it. I just sort of did it on my own. But yeah, I was like, I want to track out, basically I was interested in genealogies and actually mapping it out by year. So I made this spreadsheet. It was like, I don't know, 10 feet long or something like that, where like everything was laid out and it was like, you know, handwritten on what were. And it was deeply fascinating I tend to be very visual when I read this stuff, and you know, names and dates and things don't really mean things to me. But when you see them laid out, at least for me, it's interesting. And it's interesting how it tracks very like consistently. But yeah, that was one of the things. I was like, holy cow, like they were in a boat for like a year.
To me, it looks like a year and 10 days.
Yeah.
From the time they enter to the time they leave.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm also the same way with the visual and the numbers, and I did the same thing for the kings of Israel and Judah, because
mm-hmm.
when you're just reading and this and that, it doesn't
yeah.
make sense. But when you see it mapped out, it's
yeah.
like, oh, it's so much clearer.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it almost looks like, rereading the passage, that the waters rose for 40 days, they sat steady for 150 days,
mm-hmm.
and then they receded for another, how many it
several
was?
Several months.
Right, right. So it almost seems like the prevailing is just the staying the same.
Correct.
And then going down.
Correct, yeah, right, exactly. And I would say that would be the correct reading. You know, you don't hear too much, but by way of bad reading, but
yeah.
There are a few instances where there are some bad readings, and next week we will definitely be parking in a lot of different readings about a particular story that, you know,
mm.
hopefully we all know, maybe, but. So I want to turn, or actually before I go on to this, is there anything else that stands out?
Yes.
Yeah.
So the raven, didn't the raven come back once, but then the second time didn't come back at all?
Yes.
So I find that weird, though, because when the raven didn't come back at all, the dove could still not find a resting place for her foot. So how is the raven? Did he die? Is he just flying around with no place of rest whatsoever? Like, that makes no sense to me. Or do ravens have a different standard of being able to rest versus a dove? Like,
I don't know.
I almost wonder if the raven just flat out died from exhaustion and, like, into the water.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't say. Again, make of that what you will. that would be an area that, you know, that it hasn't captured my attention, and I'm not sure, I guess, right, that's something.
No, it hasn't only going out once. My reading is verse 6 and verse 7. After 40 days, Noah opened the window and sent out the raven, and the raven kept flying back and forth until the waters dried up.
Yeah.
So it sounds like he's just like hovering out there for like...
days.
Yeah.
Months, I think it's like months, right?
Supernatural raven.
So, yeah. Whereas the dove goes out two times.
Yeah, it's, okay. I mean, at least in reading of this, one gets the idea that the raven just has freedom to come and go as it pleases, and it's, you know, flying around, it goes out, comes back.
Finds floating detritus to land on or whatever.
The dove apparently is a homebody, and raven is...
Well, it's a more delicate bird. It's a smaller bird. Mm-hmm. I think the raven is a very large, powerful bird.
Yeah. The ravens are, they're big. They're
tough. I think that was very tough.
I spent a lot of time with ravens over the break. It was, Japan is filled with ravens everywhere,
Wow.
And they're large, they're big, they're huge birds, and they're just everywhere, and so let's look at the issue of these animals. So we see here that Noah is making an offering of these, of every clean land and air dwelling critter, whatever those designations of clean and unclean are, we don't know. But this is interesting. Chapter 9, verse 2, "And the fear of you and the terror of you shall be on every beast of the earth and on every bird of the sky, with everything that creeps on the ground, and all the fish of the sea, into your hand they are given." This is where we see that God is sort of getting rid of designations of clean and unclean. But that statement about the fear of you and the terror of you will be on every beast is odd to me. I don't know if it is odd to you.
No, it's not.
It almost sounds like it didn't exist before the flood.
Yeah, right. It sounds like Eden before the flood.
Right, and we have only one or two examples of animals that showed no fear in front of humans, and what happened was humans wiped them off the face of the earth. Because
the dodo bird,
dreadful monstrosity. I believe God, of course, since he designed his creatures to survive, this is part of it, because he knew they wouldn't survive if they were not terrified of us. I've seen humans that are just so stupid. They don't even mean to hurt animals, but they're so ignorant about how to care for them and what to do or not to do, like just toads, that it's like, oh yeah, let's hold the toad up, swing it around, and it keeps jumping onto hard concrete, and eventually it dies. Like, what a shock. Or holding the fish out of water while it's struggling to breathe and just showing everybody until it dies. Like, we're just stupid sometimes.
Yeah.
On top of, you know, hunting things to extinction.
Yeah. It is... You know, that is actually an idea that I had not considered. The fear and the terror is for the benefit of the animals, not for the disadvantage of humans. Right? They're given into your hands to eat, but, you know, they have fear and the good sense. Yeah, it is weird. I've often wondered that as a kid. I'm like, man, for the most part, all animals, you put them out in the field and they're just comfortable with each other. But you send a human out there and everybody runs, like everybody's fleas. It doesn't make a ton of sense.
No.
Right? Like, we're all part of this world. What is it that even the critters know that we're different from everybody else? And, it's weird.
What's interesting, I just recently learned of a study that was done a couple years ago, within the last 3 years. Scientists have been able to show that if you do something to a generation of mice, their kids will have a fear of the same stimulus even when never exposed to it, and it will continue to their grandkids.
Yep.
And they try to say that humans can be the same way, but truthfully, it's never been tested on humans, so that might not be the case.
Yeah, right,
but
for ethical reasons, you couldn't.
Yeah.
Right.
But yeah, they talk about, you know, obviously the idea of sort of generational trauma and things like that.
So,
I mean, that's
so it could
weird.
Be, you know, animals have had humans hunting them, and they're terrified, and then that fear of the humans then passes to their children and their children's children, and it can be increased or decreased as the experiences happen. So if the kids have a lesser experience with humans and fear, then their kids will have a lesser fear factor, but it'll still be there, and vice versa. If there's a greater instance, then the grandkids will have greater fear.
Mm-hmm. It's an oddity for sure. A lot of that kind of weird, almost genetic hardwiring of information is a strange thing. Well, anything else that stands out in this?
I just wish the Bible elaborated more clearly on how Noah knew to create a burnt offering sacrifice. Like, there's just no information given. We have seen historically that somebody else had offered a sacrifice. I can't remember. But, you know, like, there's no instructions given. There's no, like, and so the Spirit spoke to Noah, and he realized that at this point it's very appropriate for him to offer a burnt offering to the Lord. Like, there's just no, he just does it, and I just say he does it, and that's it. And it's like, that would not be my first instinct after a year on a boat with animals and we're finally free, is, oh, I should kill some of them and burn them to the Lord. Like,
well, I mean, the idea of the offerings obviously goes back to Cain and Abel, right?
So, yeah.
The one offering is rejected and the other one is accepted, so it would seem that that is the first, so it goes back to the beginning. So presumably the knowledge of that isn't lost, and whatever these, again, designations of clean and unclean, however Noah knew about them, the fact that the text doesn't explain things, and this is something that I think is worth noting. Whenever a text takes the time to explain something, that tells you that the readers didn't know about it, and they weren't expected to know about it. If a text mentions something out of hand and doesn't bother to explain it, it assumes that the reader already knows what that is, and it's so commonplace and so ordinary that it doesn't deserve or need explanation. So that, at least for us, tells us this notion of sacrifice, whatever it looked like, and whatever these designations of clean and unclean were, they were so well known, presumably to everybody. It's just, you know, Noah's the only person who bothered, you know, to keep at it. But you don't see that picked up again until you have the Mosaic Law given. And there, too, God doesn't say, oh, these are the ones that used to be. God just simply says, this is what the list is going to be, and I'm giving it to you just so that you can begin to make distinctions between things.
Well, there, Jacob, I can't remember if Abram did it. I think he did, but I know specifically Jacob, when he, like, slept at Beth-El, and there were visions from God, like, he'd offer a sacrifice there. That was before Mosaic Law.
Yeah, and again, we don't know, for example, like, practicing ecstasy, which, you know, would be considered witchcraft, and which would be not okay, and yet God, right, like, I'm going to, basically dividing of the animals, I'm going to, basically, you would cut open an animal, you take the internal organs, and you would essentially either pass them through a fire, you do a ritual with them. And so it was a way of practicing divination. And so you see these, right, the fathers of this Abrahamic covenant are practicing divination. Of course, we see too that they have household idols and deities and things. And so we can't expect them. There's an idea that after the flood, the human race sort of goes just completely wild with respect to knowledge of God, because it isn't until really you come to Abram that God just shows up out of thin air, and here's this, he's just minding his own business, he's a pagan, like, you know, he doesn't know anything. And again, we have to be careful not to retcon all that stuff back into the reading. The thing I mentioned last week, I had a student one time say, oh, well, Abraham was a good Christian. Like, literally not true. He was a good pagan. He was a pagan. You know, he didn't know anything. And so you have to really appreciate the idea of this deity. He doesn't know who this deity is. This deity just shows up and says, go to the land, I will show you.
Yeah, but it's interesting about Abraham, because God speaks to Abraham,
mm-hmm.
and Abraham actually listens.
Yes, sure.
And so what's going on there? If Abraham just, hey, he was just a guy, and there was nothing.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this voice, and he actually listens to him.
Yeah.
And obeys him.
Sure.
I mean, that's astounding.
Yeah, I do not think that people appreciate that, just that scene enough. Like, it's really extraordinary.
I mean, it is.
You're minding your own business, and, like, somebody shows up and says, hey, like, come work for me. Or it's almost like when Jesus just shows up on the scene and says, hey, like, follow me, right? It's the same kind of concept. And there are some people that do and others don't. I mean, we see people come up to Jesus like, hey, I want to follow you. And Jesus is like, all right, well, do this and then follow me. And then the people are like, okay, I'll pass on that. So it is possible. We've mentioned this before. Obviously, the text doesn't say. It is possible that God approached other people
who rejected him.
Who didn't, and that's, you know, they're not part of the story.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it is Abram who said yes. Yeah, it's extraordinary. Was that a hand or no? I thought there was a hand up. Maybe not.
I had my hand up originally when you mentioned cutting the animals in half. That was the only time I recall seeing that in the Bible, was when God commanded Abram, when he says, look up at the sky and see the stars, and your generations will be way more than that. Before that meeting, he actually commands him to get these animals, prepare them, split them apart, and then you just read like this disembodied censer and flaming torch or something going between them.
Yeah.
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 So that was God himself.
Yeah. But it's interesting that he is directing him to do what is a practice that was already known in the ancient world to be a method of divination.
Okay. I didn't know that. I don't study history.
So there too, I think in a sense, what we see often is when God shows up, God speaks the language of the people, right? It's not like God needed this to happen in order, right? And I think too that these ways of God doesn't sort of drop a nuke on people and speak to them in a way that is so outside their experience that they can't access it. You know, like imagine God showing up to Abram and saying, okay, I'm going to tell you about cell phones or something like that. Like it's so alien that it's a bridge too far for communication. And so I think you see hints of this in the giving of the Mosaic Law, where God says, I'm doing this so that you can begin to learn how to make distinctions between things. And it's like there's in the subtext, it's like not because these animals are actually clean or unclean. I'm just doing this so that you can begin almost to train them how to see this is not like these other things. And again, you see this repetition of you're to do it this way, not as the heathens do. You're to do it this way, not that way. Because they just don't know any better. And it's easy for us to read back the law into Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob when they didn't have it. You know, like the golden calf, we think, well, how could they have been so stupid? Well, what else were they? Like, that would have been completely normal. I mean, like, why not make a golden calf? Because that's what you would do. if you don't know any better. But we're like, oh, how could you be so stupid? Well, we would have done the same thing because that's what you do.
The stupid part is Aaron says, this is the God that brought you out of the land of Egypt. After having spoken with him directly, seeing the staff, the snake, all their interactions, to literally take their gold, make a calf, and say, this is the God. That's the stupid part.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. He knew who God was.
Yeah, but again, it's right. Like I think of the disciples living with Jesus, and then you hear some of the questions that they ask. You're like, are you that dumb?
Yes.
You live with this dude for three years. Most of what you've learned isn't in here. I mean, think about that. Three years. It doesn't take 3 years to read the Gospels. You could read all four Gospels in a weekend.
I just read the woman at the well account again, and it's one of those famous bloopers of the disciples. Jesus says, I have bread that you know not of, or something like that. And the disciples immediately said, could someone have brought him bread?
Utter cluelessness.
Yeah.
And so I think, if nothing else, reading that kind of stuff hopefully is a mirror so that we don't think, oh, these dumb people, not like me, because I could be, so silly. But, I think we'll leave it for here. We're going to come back and retouch the beginning of chapter 9 because chapter 9 has a very interesting story in it that has many, many, many scholars expending lots and lots of ink over, and I'm looking forward to that one there. So,
you know, the disciples understanding who he was, I keep thinking back to that night when they were in the boat, and he walks on the water.
Yep.
Now, come on, really? Something must have popped into their heads at that point and said, well, this is not just any dude.
Sure.
This is somebody that I don't know anything about.
Well, yeah, I mean, right, at first they think it's an apparition. And even something like Peter, saying, hey, like, call me out. If it's you, then, call me out on the waves. I mean, you do have, these are complex characters, this same guy who is so afraid of public opinion of him that he will deny Jesus three times.
Yeah.
Is the same person who stepped out on water. Right? Like it's right, these are not cartoon, cardboard cutout characters. These are real people. And in our own lives, we all have these times where we shine in our own ways, and then where we shine in the other end of the spectrum. Right?
But seeing a miracle, you could sort of rationalize at some level why that happened.
Yeah.
But to see a guy walk on water.
Yeah.
I mean, goodness sake.
Yeah,
but at the same time, one of the biggest examples of deliberate blindness is when the Pharisees saw that Lazarus was raised from being dead for 4 days. Their first instinct is, well, let's just kill Lazarus because he's making people follow Jesus. The man was dead for 4 days. Now he's alive and you want to kill Jesus and kill him.
Mm-hmm.
The guy, take up your mat and walk on the Sabbath.
Yeah.
Their first thought isn't, wow, that dude had literally been verifiably lame all his life. This is amazing. It's immediately like, oh, we got to kill him too. He just picked up his mat and walked on the Sabbath. Like, just so willfully blind. That was clearly a miracle.
Yeah, we humans are really good at
rationalization.
Yeah, right. I mean, we're not just rational creatures. We are rationalizing creatures.
Yeah.
And that is one of our great powers. That and forgetting. Rationalizing what we do, rationalizing the truth that we want to be true, and forgetting what is the truth and that we should be doing. Those are our two superpowers.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's boogie And, you know, we'll meet same bat time, same bat place.
We're finishing early? It's only 11:05.
Yeah.
We're done?
06.
Well, yeah, 06. I mean, I feel like I'm always dragging it so close to the edge. I guess, you know, we can continue a bit if you'd like, if there's any final thoughts on this. But I tell you what, I'll give you homework to read ahead, if you will, chapter 9, and make of this what you will, and then that way we're not just reading it straight cold. Yeah, that's gonna be good fun. So nice. Yeah, actually, to the Fountains of the Deep, I've heard some speculative, you know, exposition on the idea that it's at that moment that Pangaea breaks apart.
Yes.
That it's precisely because of the, you know, whatever is occurring, you know, geologically to allow all these fountains to let loose is also what is breaking the plates apart. Because, and I was like, as a kid, I was like, wait a minute, you know, even before I learned about, you know, Pangaea, you know, I'm reading this, I'm like, what? The Bible makes it seem like all the land was all in one spot. I'm like, well,
yeah,
that doesn't fit with the globe, right? Like, that doesn't make sense. And then you read other passages where it says, oh, like, I forget whose name it is, but basically in his days, like, the lands were divided up. And I'm like, okay, that's weird.
Yes.
So, yeah, you there does...
There is a reference, books after this.
I mean, you know, Pangaea was a thing, and that, like, the plates did, in fact, move apart from each other. What would be strange is how this text would be able to determine that all the land used to be together. Like, that by itself, to me, is extraordinary. You know, and then when I first learned about Pangaea, I'm like, whoa, okay, so that's like what the Bible, that's like what the Bible says. And, huh, well, that's interesting.
Well, you look at South America and you look at Africa.
Oh, yeah, all of them. Of
and
course,
they made
yeah,
up.
Of course, of course. And, I mean, like, geologically we know, because there are things that exist in both places with respect to the fossil record that, like, yeah, they match up. So, again, how this text would be able to articulate that. Again, a lot of that stuff you just sort of skim over and you don't, you know, most people don't really pay attention to it, but I'll never forget as a kid, I'm like, what? All the ground was like all together? I'm like, that's weird. Like, why would it, like an eyeball, kind of?
Well, we also, considering the original audience, we have the benefit of satellite imagery as well as cartography, whereas back then they did not. So what if you explain to them that everything was one landmass and now it's all over the entire sphere, they would have no concept as to what that means or looks like, because they've never seen the Earth from outer space or had it mapped out. Like,
yeah, and I actually recall, you know, since, right, it's been since all of this as a kid, but there were writings for going way back critiquing, you know, belief and the scriptures and say, well, for example, the Bible teaches that all the lands used to be together in one place, and that's obviously false, so we know that it's not true. Well, that was before the concept of Pangaea, in which case, well, okay, well, it is true, right? Whoops.
Yeah.
You know, so many of the times you see these kinds of criticisms, and it's like, well, this proves that the Bible can't be true, because as everybody knows, that's not what the world looks like, but as we now know, that is what the world used to look like. So, yeah, very interesting. Well,
all right,
yeah,
now we'll let you go.
Thank you. Well, I'll pray us out this morning. Dear Lord, I thank you for my brothers and sisters. I thank you for your word and for the delight in digging therein. I ask that you be with us these days and this week, and let us do all things to your glory. Amen.